Welcome to this sermon podcast from the Memorial Church on Emmanuel Road in Cambridge. The church website can be found at www.cambridgeunitarian.org. My name is Andrew James Brown, and I'm minister to this liberal congregation, and this is my address for the 29th of April 2012, called An Archaeologist of Mourning, Charles Olson, a Scribe Trained for the Kingdom of Heaven. As always, the sermon here draws on my own faith and experience, and it is offered to the congregation and to you in this podcast, simply as an encouragement to further reflection and thought. It is most certainly not a definitive statement with which you must agree. As my 16th century Polish Socinian forebears said, "Whilst we declare our own opinions, we oppress no one. Let every person enjoy the freedom of their own judgment in religion. Only let it be permitted to us also to exhibit our view of divine things, without injuring and calumniating others." In this spirit, I bid you welcome. This address begins with four short readings. The first is from Mark, chapter 1, verses 35 to 38. "And in the morning, rising up a great while before day, Jesus went out and departed into a solitary place, and there prayed. And Simon, and they that were with him, followed after him. And when they had found him, they said unto him, All men seek for thee. And he said unto them, Let us go into the next towns, that I may preach there also. For therefore I came forth." And a single verse from Matthew, chapter 13, verse 52. Jesus said, "Every scribe who has been trained for the kingdom of heaven is like the master of a household, who brings out of his treasure what is new and what is old." And just a couple of sentences from Henry David Thoreau's Walden Pond, from chapter 2, Where I Lived, and the experiment of which Henry David Thoreau is speaking about was, of course, the whole business of being by Walden Pond in solitude, writing the book. He said, "The present was my next experiment of this kind, which I purpose to describe at more length, for convenience putting the experience of 2 years into one. As I have said, I do not propose to write an ode to dejection, but to brag as lustily as a chanticleer in the morning, standing on his roost, if only to wake my neighbours up." And lastly, two short passages from Charles Olson's essay, The Present is Prologue. The first is from the very beginning of the essay, and the last couple of sentences are taken from the very end. He said, "My shift is that I take it, the present is prologue, not the past. The instant, therefore, is its own interpretation, as a dream is, and any action, a poem, for example. Down with causation. And yourself, you, as the only reader and mover of the instant, you, the cause, no drag allowed on either. Get on with it. In the work and dogmas are, one, how by form to get the content instant. Two, what any of us are by the work on ourself, how to make ourselves fit instruments for use. How we augment the given, what used to be called our fate. Three, that there is no such thing as duality, either of the body and the soul, or of the world and I. That the fact in the human universe is the discharge of the many, the multiple, by the one. Yourself done right, whatever you are, in whatever job, is the thing. All hierarchies, like dualities, are dead ducks." And from the very end of the essay, Olson said, "I find it awkward to call myself a poet or a writer. If there are no walls, there are no names. This is the morning, after the dispersion, and the work of the morning is methodology. How to use oneself, and on what. That is my profession. I am an archaeologist of mourning." An image often found in spiritual writing is that of the morning. Almost universally, getting up early to pray or meditate is understood as a good and cleansing practice, one which prepares one well for the necessary work to be done. My question in this address is, what is it about the image and actuality of morning that is so powerful for the theological mind? My own key loci classici for this morning spirituality are some of the passages you heard earlier, first one from the Gospel of Mark, and the second from Henry David Thoreau's Walden. I'll come back to the biblical texts and Olson's in a moment. Over the years, the Gospel of Mark and Henry David Thoreau's Walden have powerfully and continually encouraged me to try this early morning spirituality, not least of all in a number of visits to the Benedictines at Core Abbey on the Isle of Wight. And trust me, they do early. Alas, natural proclivity, plus a life spent as a professional jazz musician, has always cut against this. Consequently, it's true to say that in my own life, early mornings have almost only ever been experienced after the long gig and subsequent drive home. And more often than not, I've observed the sun rise not like Jesus, ready to go into the next towns, or, like Thoreau, to brag lustily as a chanticleer, but simply to go to my bed and to a long, long sleep. Given that such an actual morning spirituality seems definitively closed off to me, a question that has remained throughout my life is whether something of what is meant by the morning is available to more crepuscular creatures like myself, perhaps under another practice or form. In short, what is being elicited when these writers use the image of morning? As I've noted elsewhere, I take it that these authors wrote what they did because they experienced in the morning certain conditions in which their minds were set in motion, which in turn allowed something to well up in the inner reaches of their consciousness. And these authors then tried to communicate their experience to us through means of aesthetic ideas and images, in this case, those associated with early morning. In other words, these writers gave us an approximation of this experience, and in so doing, gave it the semblance of objective reality. I think I want to draw out a distinction between what they were feeling and the place they were actually in, and the works that they produced where they used the image of the morning because they had been there. So there is a difference between their being in the morning and their writing about the morning. So what I'm trying to do today is, in my own words, which are a kind of variation or fantasy on a theme by Charles Olson, is to make what feels to be a meaningful and legitimate expression that approximates to what I've long felt Mark and Thoreau were doing when they were talking about mourning. And I suppose one way of looking at this address is also to see it as a kind of case study of what all of us have to do whenever we read any text and try and understand what the author is saying and meaning. Olson's work as a poet and prose writer has long been of interest to me since I picked up his early study of Herman Melville, called Call Me Ishmael, in the Arts Council-funded poetry bookshop in Colchester, where I had my first job after leaving school in 1983. The manager, who had Olson's work in stock, was an extraordinary man, himself a poet, called John Rowe. And he's still very much around, and if by any chance, John, you're listening to this, hi, I owe you a great deal. Well, I went on to do a number of wonderful madcap tours around the UK, East Germany and Poland with his avant-garde music and poetry collective called John Rowe's Sound Proposition. And on one tour, John, seeing my growing interest in Olson, he lent me Martin Duberman's book about the experimental interdisciplinary school set up in 1933 in North Carolina called Black Mountain College, which, before its closure in 1957, managed to attract a faculty that included many of America's most important artists, composers, dancers, poets, and designers and engineers. Olson became college rector during the second half of its life, and at the same time, amongst the teaching staff, were a number of other figures whose work became central to my own formation. the composers John Cage and Stefan Volpe, the poet Robert Creeley, the dancer Merce Cunningham, and the architect and engineer Buckminster Fuller. Olson, in one of his most influential prose pieces, The Present Is Prologue, which you heard just a few moments ago, wrote these words while he was at the college. And going back to them myself after some 20 years, I can see how clearly they mark out the particular path I have, since then, come to follow. Well, here there's a pause of a dramatic kind, just to let that story settle in. Because the way I've just told my story comes, of course, very naturally, because Olson's words, written 60 years ago, and read by me some 20 years ago, are in some obviously real sense in the past, and so could be thought of as forming a prologue to who I am now, speaking to you in the present about this subject. But it should be clear that telling my story in this way cuts completely against Olson's feeling that it is not the past which is prologue, but the present, this moment now. What does he mean? Well, we may begin by observing that one of Olson's major concerns throughout his career was how to get himself, his students and his readers away from theories about the world and back into a lived and experienced world. A key way he thought this could be effected was by breaking down what he came to think were the many artificial barriers that existed in our North Atlantic culture. It has long seemed to me that one of the reasons he took the post of rector at Black Mountain College was because of the anarchic interdisciplinary nature of the place, deliberately transgressed traditional academic boundaries, and brought together an astonishing range of endeavours from both the so-called humanities and the so-called sciences. There's a lovely picture, by the way, of Buckminster Fuller, the engineer and architect, in a production with Merce Cunningham. I mean, two figures you wouldn't normally expect to see together on stage. So there was this real commingling, not only of teachers, but of course also of their students. They would be in and out of each other's classes. Well, Olson thought that all these disciplines and people all belong together in a kind of geography, a complex horizon of human life within which one could and should be free to wander, looking, seeing, touching, tasting, smelling and telling. And so when he says, if there are no walls, there are no names, it is to this interdisciplinary geography that he is referring. He resists being called a poet or writer, because if there are no walls, then these names, poet and writer, really don't tell you much about what he is really up to. They only tell you something about what he does with what he's up to. Olson saw that there was another way to educate people, namely in an institution that existed after the dispersion of artificial boundaries. And this was a kind of new morning, a moment and time where one was genuinely opened up to the fullest possibilities of action that could spring from the whole human endeavour, and from which one could begin to do one's own work in a new way, whether you were doing it as an artist, so-called, or a scientist, so-called. This way of proceeding required a new methodology, and I'll come to that in a moment, but firstly I want to point to something else. As I've just said, in terms of the split between disciplines, Olson wanted to pull down all artificial walls to allow the possibility of there being this free and instantaneous movement between them. But things didn't stop there, because Olson wanted to pull down all the walls in our culture which created dualisms, especially those which created the apparently separate realms of body and soul and the world and the individual. Now please note as I say this that there is a great deal of difference between differences and dualisms. Olson is challenging dualisms, not differences. As an early example of a postmodernist, difference is actually very important to Olson. Anyway, it should be obvious that in doing this, one wall that for him came tumbling down was that which divided in a dualistic way what we have learnt to call past and that which we have learnt to call the present. He became acutely aware that in every living, alert, whole human being, the memories of the past, so-called, were not past at all, but were the always already present resonances that are the very condition for human possibility, growth, knowledge, and meaning. It is the very possibility that here and now we are able to do anything at all, and then energized with this possibility to take the next step into a new day. Like Gianni Vattimo, although some 40 years earlier, Olson saw that reality, our world, is always already experienced within horizons which are made up of a series of echoes, linguistic resources, messages from the past, messages coming from others, and others beside us, such as other cultures. And it was into this rich cultural soil that in his own poetry and prose he sought to dig, just like an archaeologist, in order to find things that were both new to him and us, but which were also, paradoxically, old. In undertaking this task, Olson seems, to me at least, to be enacting that which is gestured towards in Jesus' teaching, that every scribe who has been trained for the kingdom of heaven is like the master of a household who brings out of his treasure what is new and what is old. Olson called this treasure, this always already present soil, the morning, because when paid attention to, and without beforehand dividing it up artificially into science here and the arts there, the past behind us, the future before, this cultural soil, this soil's natural complexity, was always capable of gifting us some unique combination of different things, which could suddenly and unexpectedly show up and shine for us, in a way that called us irresistibly to our work, whether our work was going to be an act of new justice and compassion, or the composition of a new poem, piece of music or a dance, a call to see a new way to build a house or construct a dome, and then, like Jesus, to be impelled to tell what you have discovered, what you have seen, to the next towns, or, like Thoreau, to brag as lusty as a chanticleer in the morning, standing on his roost, if only to wake your neighbours up. Olson's educational point was to say to everyone he met and taught, either in person or indirectly through his work, that our rich cultural soil was always ready to give up to anyone who cared to look and to dig new light on things, a new way to see the world and to be in it. In short, every day, every hour, and every minute of our life was potentially at least a new morning, and not just one when our natural sun was rising. All we had to do was get on with it and become ourselves an archaeologist of morning.